This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachel. To be or not to be is the question from Shakespeare's Hamlet, asked on stages around the world for more than 400 years. By now, most theatergoers are familiar with the play's basic storylines about murder, death, betrayal, and doubt. But each staging of the play also has the opportunity to highlight a particular theme or lesser-known aspect of the story. Today, we're going to talk about two local productions that each bring something a little different to the drama, and we start with a production directed by 14-year-old Durham resident Leo Egger. Leo's love for the bard encouraged him to use his own bar mitzvah money to stage a community production of the play earlier this year, and he joins me from summer camp in Vermont. Leo, hello. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. How's the weather in Vermont? You're doing well? Good camp is going well?
Yeah, beautiful. 70 degrees.
Excellent. We all wish we were with you now. Well, listen, let me ask you about when you were introduced to Shakespeare and how you developed what must be a love for Shakespeare, given the fact that you took on this big project.
Well, from a very young age, about 7 or 8, my dad said that the only way me and my twin brother could get a new bike, a mountain bike, was to memorize 10 Shakespearean monologues. And so from that point, we dived into, you know, we started with Romeo and Juliet and Midsummer Night's Dream, and we moved on to Macbeth and Hamlet. And each time we memorized new monologues, and from a very young age, at 8, I really became extremely immersed in the text and interested in reading and studying Shakespeare, even just, you know, at that point, I didn't really understand the full context, but just the language alone really gave me a spark in wanting to do more and studying more.
But you're going to have to help me out with this, because a 7-year-old boy who's having to memorize 10 monologues from Shakespeare, I would have hated Shakespeare by the end of that. I'd have gotten on my bike and ridden so far away from anything Shakespearean you could never find me. So what is it? You said something about the language, but again, you don't really understand the context. I mean, you take a monologue out of context, who knows what that means? The language is a little bit unfamiliar. What kept you coming back? What was it that made you think there's something worth pursuing in this?
Well, my biggest supporter through all of my studying and learning of Shakespeare was my dad, who just his energy around the text, love for it, and his honest, you know, his passion for it really inspired me to feel an excitement about it. And from there, I from reading, I just, the stories themselves inspired me and excited me to read more stories and read more plays and understand it. And it was a lot of his help that made me really grasp and love Shakespeare.
So in seventh grade now, you become particularly attached to Hamlet. How did that happen?
Well, it's kind of a random thing. I was just in a production of Midsummer Night's Dream, and I was reading a lot of Shakespeare after that because I became really interested. And so I read Macbeth, and just like in the school library, picked up Hamlet, and it's kind of an inexplicable thing. I just really, something about the domestic and the relatable aspects of the story. Just, I really felt like I just was really drawn to the realness and the humanness of the story.
Did you read about Shakespeare and about, let's stay with Hamlet for a moment. I mean, did you read the critiques and the spark notes and the other sort of critiques and reviews to understand some of the themes and the deeper thoughts that were running through the play, or could you pull them out yourself just from reading the play?
Well, a lot of them I was able to pull out myself, and a lot of and times when I didn't understand the text, I had my dad who really helped me understand the text, because if we both look at it together, we can always discover more than when one of us looks at it together. But it was usually just I mean, I feel like that people, if you really take the time to read through the text, anyone can pull out those details, and anyone can understand it in their own light, right?
Well, let me stop you there and ask you about that, because you said it was relatable, the stories, the family, the humanity of it. I mean, not a lot of us will ever be the Prince of Denmark. We will not have our father lost to assassination and our mother in that somewhat compromised position. I mean, these are not normal for us. And that's, I think, what drew Shakespeare to the story. It was a big story. And yet, as you say, if we couldn't find a way in, if we couldn't find ourselves in those characters, it wouldn't have lasted 400 years.
Yeah.
How did you do it? Where did you find yourself in that play?
Well, so in Hamlet, even though the story is, you know, kind of ridiculous compared to our lives, I feel that the actual emotions of Hamlet, his feelings of being lost, and, you know, his angst, is all things that we all experience just in a less sense. And the feelings around the characters, while the story is not as relatable, is so human and like my life and so many other people's lives, because what Hamlet feels, what Ophelia feels, and the tension in the family is all stuff that we have felt, you know?
Right. Well, so you started your own company now, and is it true you used your own bar mitzvah money to start a production company so that you could stage Hamlet?
Yes. So I created the Eno River Players, which is a nonprofit organization, which I used to kick off Hamlet, so I could have an infrastructure to produce the play. So that was my first order of business, and I used my bar mitzvah money to raise money for everything we needed from the play, from costumes and props and lights and everything in between.
How about marketing? I mean, what did you do then? So you've got some actors now. You've got a place. You've got the lights. Now you've got to get an audience. Tell us about the marketing for this.
Well, my strategy for marketing was we had posters made. My sister does graphic design, so she made a poster that we hung around, and I made a Facebook page. We put some ads on, like NPR, trying to spread the voice of Eno River Players, so we can get, you know, people to come. But we also had people spreading the word as much as they could, trying to get people to hear about our story.
How do you think it went? I mean, again, you know, you read the play, you understand the gravity of this and the levity, I hope, the levity, and because that's, I think, one of the things that many directors miss is that, you know, Hamlet's a funny guy. He's not, right? Did you get that? You got the humor in Hamlet,
yeah,
didn't you?
We had really tried to focus on the humor in our play with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern and all, everything encompassing them, and the graveyard thing and Hamlet in general. I feel like one of the main things I kept telling our actors is just to not take themselves too seriously, because if at that point we can get out of this kind of serious fear that encompasses Hamlet, you know, Hamlet, right? If we can have them really, you know, be themselves and act it with humor and seriousness, all encompassing the character in themselves, that was something I felt like was really successful in our production.
So what did you learn in the process of doing this as a director and as a lover of Shakespeare?
I learned so much about being a leader and supporting people on when they're not doing as well as some days. And I also learned so much about the text through my actors, and we all learned. It was such a, you know, a cooperative experience, right? While I had my light to bring, other actors had their own light to bring the story, and we found a way where we could include, you know, my interpretation with, you know, what they feel about the text.
Great stuff. Well, okay, so what's next for the Ena River Players?
Well, what's next is we're going to be producing King Lear in this winter, and we're going to have auditions coming up in the late fall. So follow, you know, we have a Facebook, and we also have a website at enoriverplayers.org. So you can keep in touch about upcoming audition dates and upcoming plays. So
that sounds great. Although Lear, I mean, you're 14, you're already jumping to the end of your career, Leo.
Yeah, I know.
It's great. Well, it's a real pleasure to talk with you. What's for lunch today, by the way?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, that could be rough. Maybe it's better that you're talking on the radio. Who knows?
Yeah.
Anyway, it is a real pleasure to talk with you. Leo Egger, he enters the 10th grade at the Durham School of the Arts. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
You can find out more about Leo and the future of Eno River Player Productions at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a Raleigh-based theater company is taking on the uncut version of Hamlet that lasts almost 4 hours. We'll talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and we're talking today about the many interpretations of Hamlet. The Raleigh-based Honest Pint Theater Company is taking on the challenge of Hamlet Uncut, a close to 4-hour version of the play that highlights characters and dialogue that often get left out. The production opens tonight at Leggett Theater at William Peace University and runs through July 31st. And I'm joined here for a special preview in our studio. Jeremy Fiebig, is here. Jeremy, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you on the program.
Glad to be here.
Also with us on the program is David Henderson. He is the founder and artistic director at Honest Pint Theater Company. David, welcome. Good to have you here.
Glad to be here.
Originally, it was your idea to come up with the uncut version of Hamlet.
That is correct.
Why?
That's a good question. Sometimes I go, wow, I wish I could go back in time. No, I think Jeremy has said before, we've talked about how people refer to this play, rightly or wrongly, as the greatest play ever written. And I don't necessarily know that that's true. I don't know that it's false. But I do know that it's hard to make an assessment if you never see or hear the entire piece. So when people say it's the greatest play ever written and then proceed to cut 2/3 of it, what you lose is a full kind of version of what's going on in Elsinore at the time. Most often you lose the Fortinbras subplot, so you lose the impending sense of war. Gertrude gets cut in ways that make her an even harder character to play. Claudius becomes more of a one-dimensional villain, et cetera, et cetera. And it just kind of extrapolates on down. So we said, why not take on the whole play and present that fuller picture of what is going on.
But when you say the fuller picture or the original, perhaps,
yeah.
I mean, that gets to be tricky business too, right? Because, you know, we Shakespeare is sitting there in the wings throwing out pages night after night, right? So is there an original?
That's an excellent point, and one that we have talked a lot about. The edition that we are using, we're calling a conflated edition. It really combines the second quarto and the first folio and is as close as a definitive version of the play as you can get. But to your point, there are scenes that we're performing that may have never been performed in an entire evening of the show because somebody was coming to the show and that we don't want to offend them, so we're going to delete this. Or somebody's sick, we're not going to do this. So we don't know, and Jeremy can correct me, that there was ever a version, a complete definitive, I'm using air quotes, nobody can see me, version of the play.
Well, Jeremy, you've done some scholarly work on modern staging practices. Tell us a little bit about how that informs this production. In other words, to what extent do those cut versions inform how you're going to stage this?
Sure.
Production?
So I'd say two things. One is that a lot of scholarship of the period suggests that every performance of Hamlet was different. Every performance of every play was different, not just different because we're doing a live performance tonight, but different because of what you suggested, which is swapping in and out scenes and all of that. But one of the things we also know about the period is that it was playmakers were not necessarily addressing the play by itself as sort of a serious piece of theater or a funny piece of theater. And as you mentioned with Leo earlier, it was not a discrete thing. People were not coming necessarily just to see a play. There was a whole atmosphere around it that feels that would feel to us much more like going to a sporting event. So there was live music. That's kind of an insurance policy. You know, if the play is bad, at least you get a concert to go with it. And we're doing that in our production. And same thing with sort of audience engagement. So these plays were performed at 2 p.m. So you get some perks out of that. I mean, the audience is lit and in some cases, in some of Shakespeare's theaters on the stage. And so you'll see a little bit of that in our production. And that sort of sense of engagement and buzz and conversation to and with the audience are all sort of original context things that fit into our approach.
But that does seem to suggest that you could get away with a four-hour production back then when it was a party. People were going, everybody could, you know, again, it was all natural lighting, so the audience and the stage was kind of lit the same way. There was none of this sort of sitting silently. You can't imagine that people sat silently for 4 hours. They were,
right.
It was a fair kind of an environment. You're not going to have that now. Are you going to be okay?
I think we're going to try to recreate that as much as possible. Jeremy, I love one of the first times we all got together and started discussing the play, we talked about food and beverages and live music as an insurance policy against a bad play, right? And I loved that phrase. But really what it is it creates that event. And we're going as far as we can in this, quote, modern age to create that party atmosphere so that prior to the show there's live music, there'll be food and people can mill around. There's going to be live music at the intermissions that's actually performed by our cast. And they'll be milling around meeting the audience. So trying to break down that barrier between actor and audience and create this kind of pub-like experience in a lot of ways.
Well, two of the cast are here today, Tamara Farias and Simon Kaplan. Tamara plays Gertrude. Simon plays Claudius. And first of all, let me welcome you both to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Maybe you could do a scene for us, and should I have you set this up so I can allow our characters to get in?
Actually, I'll be in it as well. We're going to do scene 1-2, which is the court scene where we first meet Claudius, Gertrude, and Hamlet, and it is a conversation about death of fathers.
Take thy fair hour, Laertes, time be thine, and thy best graces, spend it at thy will. But now, my cousin Hamlet and my son.
A little more than kin and less than kind.
How is it that the clouds still hang on you?
Not so, my lord. I am too much in the sun.
Good Hamlet, cast thy nighted color off, and let thine eye look like a friend on Denmark. Do not forever with thy veiled lids seek for thy noble father in the dust. Thou knowest 'tis common. All that lives must die, passing through nature to eternity.
Aye, madam, it is common.
If it be, why seems it so particular with thee?
Seems, madam, nay, it is. I know not seems. 'Tis not alone my inky cloak, good mother, nor customary suits of solemn black, nor windy suspiration of forced breath, nor the dejected havior of the visage, nor the fruitful river of the eye, together with all moods, shapes, forms of grief, that can denote me truly. These indeed seem. But I have that within which passes show these but the very trappings and suits of woe.
Actors Tamara Farias, Simon Kaplan, and David Henderson doing a scene from Hamlet, part of a production staged by Honest Pint Theater that opens at William Peace University's Leggett Theater tonight. Tamara, let me ask you about playing Gertrude, because she's somebody who, much has been written about this, and I sometimes feel it, that we don't really get, and you mentioned it too, David, we don't get a three-dimensional sense of who she is. How is it to play Gertrude in this play and in this longer version? Do you have a deeper sense of who she is?
As far as how it is to play her, it's terrifying and exciting. She's always been on my bucket list of roles that I've wanted to play, but she's a very well-known character. And so when you're playing a role that is so well-known, you don't want to disappoint the audience by giving them something that they're not expecting. And at the same time, you want to, as an actor, put your own mark on the role. So it's been really delightful to work with Honest Pint on this show and create a Gertrude that is loving and kind and interesting and a little bit more three-dimensional, I hope.
What's it like to be in a production like this? Obviously, you need a fair amount of stamina, both, I mean, not only for each night, but also in the preparation for this.
Absolutely. And Jeremy warned us, and David warned us, and I'm not sure that we took him seriously, and we sure are feeling it now. We're exhausted by the end of the night, but it's been such an incredible experience to actually, I mean, it's really an event. As opposed to just a play that we're putting on.
Well, let's, Jeremy, tell us about some of what we may have been missing. You talked about Fortinbras. You know, this is this impending invasion, you know, that sort of looms over the play. How much more do we get of that, and what part does it play? Does it change things much?
Sure. I mean, I think a common approach to this play, to get it down to sort of palatable, sort of movie size, today means cutting out the Fortinbras track. That's probably the most common cut. And there's some other things that are sort of more internal, like parts of conversation and digressions that end up getting cut too. The Fortinbras thing, I think if you take it out, you lose a big piece of the poetry and certainly of the plot. So if you take it out, Hamlet becomes a sort of domestic play almost. You get to stop considering the national and international implications of these people's actions, and it's really just, you know, son, uncle, mother, friends, that kind of thing. And so keeping Fortinbras and keeping that presence of this looming conflict it helps with the scale of the piece and how it feels to an audience.
Well, it's always felt, too, that the question of the state is the question of the human, right? I mean, it's all a contrivance, and this is one of Hamlet's sort of questions, is one of his concerns, is like, to what extent am I making up my identity? And now that I think about it, how can the state be a state if I know a crime has been committed? God knows the crime. You know, some eternal knows a crime has been committed, and yet the state goes on. Therefore, this must be a fiction. So having something kind of loom over the top of this to say, and we can smash it with a sword in 10 minutes, is kind of a brilliant piece, right? It's a brilliant frame. You cut it out and you don't feel that multidimensional. It's human, it's social, it's political. All of these things are constructs.
That's right.
Which Shakespeare's building. So we lose it when we lose Fortinbras until the very end.
That's right. And you know, Fortinbras is a very small part, but a great example of Hamlet's foil. He has several of them in the play. Laertes is another, but here is a young prince in exactly Hamlet's position, who is choosing to act in ways that Hamlet is not. And that's an important piece of the poetry as well.
And fatherhood is also a part of this. And so Polonius, I think we're going to get a scene now that features Polonius, are we not?
It's actually Claudius and Hamlet.
This is okay,
yeah.
All right.
Well, it's about Polonius.
Can we do that scene now?
We sure can.
All right, guys. And maybe you set it up for us. So where are we in the play?
In the play, this is immediately after Hamlet has accidentally slain Polonius. And Rosencrantz and Guildenstern have been sent to find him. They find him, and they bring him before Claudius.
Now, Hamlet, where's Polonius?
At supper.
At supper? Where?
Not where he eats, but where he has eaten. A certain convocation of politic worms are eating at him now. Your worm is your only emperor for diet. We fat all creatures to fat us, and we fat ourselves for maggots. Your fat king and your lean beggar is but variable service. Two dishes but to one table. That's the end.
Alas, alas.
A man may fish with the worm that hath ate of a king, and eat of the fish that hath fed of that worm.
What dost thou mean by this?
Nothing but to show you how a king may go progress through the guts of a beggar.
Where is Polonius?
In heaven. Send thither to see. If your messenger find him not there, seek him in the other place yourself. But indeed, if you find him not within a month, you shall nose him as you go up the stairs into the lobby.
Simon Kaplan and David Henderson doing a scene from Hamlet. They are part of a production staged by Honest Pint Theater, and it opens at William Peace University's Leggett Theater tonight. Simon, talk about the process for this production. It began a while ago, but you were getting into character a lot earlier, I understand, than you might for a normal production.
Yeah, the first meeting we had for this was, I believe, in December. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Casting was done in November. We met monthly for the first few months. The first meeting in December was just to talk about the the whole process, how it was going to be to get to know each other a bit, because although some of us had worked together before, others had not. I don't think I knew anybody in the cast when I at that first meeting. But over the first three or four meetings, we read through the play. It was a conventional read-through, but also stopping to do some text analysis and to just figure out a little bit more what was going on. And then I think it was in May that we started doing some real close detail work on the text and staging. And then had a, I think it was about 3 week hiatus where, during which we were all sent off to learn our lines, of which there are many, 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 it being the uncut version.
we're up over 4,000.
Something like that. Yeah. It's a long play.
Yeah.
And then we came back, at the beginning of June, since when it has been full on.
Yeah.
I'm just working, we've had maybe half a dozen nights off since the beginning of June.
Well, David, let me ask you about this process, but also about something that Tamara mentioned, which is, you know, she plays Gertrude. We all mm-hmm. know, we all know this play. I mm-hmm. mean, even if we don't know it, we quote it daily,
right,
you know.
Right.
And even if we know don't know, we're quoting it.
Yeah,
we do. So what about that? The challenge of sort of working with a play that kind of everybody thinks they know,
yeah.
and adding to it in ways that they may not recognize.
It's an excellent point, and I think one of the biggest challenges as an actor playing Hamlet is there's always this one speech that everybody knows. I call it theater karaoke. you walk out on stage and you start to be or not to be,
yeah.
and 90,000 people are there going, I hope, mumbling with you, right?
Yeah.
They're saying it as you speak it. So the question that we have faced and Jeremy and I have worked on and throughout the play, since it's so iconic, is how do we challenge that expectation? How do we change it? How do we shift it up? How do we make To Be or Not to Be fresh, right. still respecting the text, still telling the story, but at the same time giving a nod or a wink to the audience that, look, we know that you all have heard this speech before. We know you're probably speaking it while David is saying it. So we're playing a lot with that, but it's a challenge.
You want to go the Rocky Horror Picture Show route? You're not going to go that far.
Not that extreme. but you mentioned before we went on the air about Gielgud and the humor, and I think that's something that we're looking to find within the play, because otherwise Hamlet is a kind of a jerk. You know, he's kind of a melancholic jerk. And if he's more humorous at times, then it makes him more relatable. And then after 3.5 hours with him, the audience is moved when he finally, spoiler, dies.
But he was ready.
Yes, he was.
And that is
the readiness was all.
That was all. See, well, that's the other thing is the way we quote it. And I think this is the other hard part. It's the speech we think we know, and then we're all sort of humming along with you. But then there's sort of the misinterpretation. When Polonius gives Laertes his parting advice, you know, neither lender nor borrower be until thine own self be true, we quote that as though it's good advice. The point was it's vapid, stupid advice from a guy who's not thinking at all about his child and could care less, which is why Laertes the guy is. And we quote it as though it's wise. And how do you sort of shake that up and have folks realize that this guy doesn't give a hoot about his son or hadn't thought deeply about it?
Well, I mean, thank you for pointing that out. It's something we've worked on, so hopefully we deliver. And I guess what I would say is that close encounters with the text, really spending time to ask what this means, clarifies that. And I think so much of sort of modern reading experience is just to sort of get through it, mm-hmm. get the information, and move along. In a play that is not concerned about – in a production that's not concerned about its own time constraints, you can spend that kind of time figuring out not just the placeholder meaning that will get you through a lot of productions, but the real thing, and we're finding it there for sure.
David, how have your ideas about the play changed and sort of what have you learned in the process of doing this production?
I think the big thing – and I said this the other night in rehearsal – is that doing a complete version of the text – you start to realize what words get repeated over and over again that Shakespeare uses. You know, we hear the word fortune a lot. We hear the word incestuous a lot. And even in a cut version, those words repeat. But in a full version, you start to hear them coming out of other players' mouths in different ways. And when you do that, you start to realize that what Shakespeare was doing was truly creating this amazing tapestry. And when you pull out some of those little threads, we lose some of the picture's still beautiful, but when you get right up on it, like Jeremy said, the close relationship with it, you start to realize there are little pieces missing. And for me, I started to realize that the play is a lot better constructed than I ever thought it was.
Great stuff, and you'll have a chance to see it starting tonight, I think. Are you getting going tonight?
We have a ticketed preview tonight.
All
Our
right.
official opening is tomorrow night at William Peace University.
And you go through the 31st. So
we sure do.
Jeremy Fiebig is here, David Henderson, Tamara Farias, and Simon Kaplan, all part of the uncut production of Hamlet. It opens tonight, and then the big opening is in the future, and we've got all that at our website, stateofthings.org. The production by Raleigh's Honest Pint Theater Company is on stage at Leggett Theater at William Peace University through July 31st. And as I say, our website has the information as well, stateofthings.org. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we'll learn how to listen to the sounds of silence, a new documentary that examines the virtue of said silence. And we'll talk about it in a moment. Stay tuned.